it doesn't always need to make sense. Like, your brain is such a complex, labyrinthian, like, mess. And it might just be that a certain smell triggers you, but you don't know why. It's not that it was the smell that you smelled in the room at the time, but at some point in your life, your brain made a connection between a sight and a sound, and that led to a smell. And somehow this thing has become tangled in a way it shouldn't be. It's become intertwined in your brain with some kind of horrible incident or time in your life.
You're listening to the Who Hurt You podcast. I still don't have a jingle, but thank you for listening to Who Hurt You, an interview podcast hosted by me, comedian and author Sophie Hagen. In this episode, I am speaking to YouTuber, is it still called that? YouTube personality? YouTube celebrity? Anyways, life is short, let's go with YouTuber. She's a YouTuber, author, and a filmmaker, and a mental health advocate. We had a real dive into the topic of mental health, and if I know my audience the way I think I do, I'm sure you'll all find it very relatable. So please enjoy my chat with the wonderfully charming Hazel Hayes.
I am in my kitchen. It's a little past noon. It's on the 30th of March. It's the second sunny day of the year. Maybe the last sunny day of the year. Who knows? It's the UK. I have that thing where, you know, when you've cried a lot the day before, your eyes are like puffy. And so
I call it emotional hangover.
I like that. Yes, I'm in an emotional hangover, but I'm feeling fine. But it's one of those things. Am I feeling fine or am I just numb? You know, am I feeling fine or am I feeling nothing?
We'll go with fine. We'll go with fine.
And what's happening in the world? We're still, we're technically still in lockdown, but now we can meet people outside. There's still a global pandemic. I don't know if that boat in the canal has gotten loose or whatnot.
I heard it was out last night.
Oh, good for that.
All I know is oil prices started to fix themselves last night. Don't ask why I know this, but if that's on the mend, then the boat's probably out.
Good to know. So there was a boat stuck in a canal and now it's loose. Good for it. Good for the boat. And I am here on Zoom with Hazel Hayes, which is so exciting. So Hazel, where are you at the moment, both sort of physically and emotionally?
Where am I? This is such a huge question to launch in with. We'll go with the easy one first. I'm in my kitchen / living room, which I think is very common for most people now, that it's the room, it's the office, it's where I work, where I live, where I watch TV, where I do everything. Mentally and emotionally, I'm good. I'm good. I'm a bit overwhelmed by all the work I have on at the moment. I'm a little bit frazzled. I've just started seeing a new therapist, so sort of navigating that at the moment. But yeah, I'm on the scale of where Hazel can be in comparison to how low I can go, I'd say I'm quite good at the moment. Yeah,
what's that scale? What's the best and the worst?
I mean the worst is we're here, you know what, we're 2 minutes into the podcast and we're here. I mean, absolute worst is not wanting to be here at all, which I think more people than you know experience that, so probably every single person listening has experienced it at some point. That's absolute rock bottom. And the absolute best is the days when you forget you have a brain. You know, the days when you're not aware of yourself and your thoughts and your feelings and your anxiety and your depression and all those other things. And you sort of get to the end of the day and go, I just got up and lived a day and I had a really nice time. I saw some people, I did some things, I've been productive, I went to bed. And yeah, an uneventful day is probably the best.
So you say when you're not, this is going to be very, very pedantic, I think, but when you say you're not aware of your thoughts and your feelings,
yeah.
Do you mean that you're not in your head about it? Or do you mean that you don't feel anything either? Or is it one of those days where you don't overthink things, but you do just feel them without having to have your brain try and stop it?
Exactly. I hear what you're saying. No, it's not numbness. I think for me, when I'm at my absolute worst, I remember I remember a particular moment when I was at a period where I look back on as my lowest. And I remember I went to visit my mom back in Ireland, like just to be looked after, like just to try and kind of get through this horrible patch. I'd just been put on antidepressants and I was not reacting well to them at all. There were days she literally would just put me in the car and take me out, because just to move my body from place to place, just to get me out. And I remember, like, she was driving through Raheny or something and she popped into the shop and I was just watching people go by and I was so jealous of them because they were just living their day. And I don't know what those people had going on. I mean, in reality, it's entirely possible any number of them were going through something very difficult. But all I saw was people going about their day and seeming fine. And that's all I wanted. I wasn't asking for the world. I just wanted to not be in my head, not be aware of pain or suffering or negative thoughts or any of that kind of stuff. And to be, I guess, aware of gratitude and aware of the beauty in the world. Not that you're not aware, but to just not feel every feeling, not hear every thought out loud, echoed on repeat. Yeah, that's what I mean.
I had this realization where it was one of those, I woke up and I started thinking about what I had to do that day. And it just became 2 hours of going, so I need to shower, but I can't shower before I've had breakfast, but I can't have breakfast before I've showered. And also I need to do this and then I need to do that. And what, mm-hmm. Oh God, this is so hard. It's too much. It's too much. And then I had this weird thought of, oh, hang on. Some people don't think about these things. Yeah. They just do.
They just get up and do things. And then there's some days I'm so grateful for that. There's some days when I am feeling good and I'm so grateful for tiny things, you know, like, oh my God, this sandwich tastes amazing today. And, oh, I really love this TV show I'm watching. Like, I love how this is shot. Or, God, I love that song that's playing. Like, you just, you're hearing things and you're so aware of your senses and that sort of that tingly pleasure feeling that you get from things. And I think that's the blessing. There's a blessing and a curse that comes with being this way. And obviously the curse is when things are bad, they're really, really bad. But when they're good, like, you really feel that goodness. And I then sort of feel sorry for people who it's just a complete anti what I was just saying. Like, I feel sorry for people who just go through life and don't stop, you know, to to smell the roses, as it were, or listen to the birds, or just appreciate a really lovely moment that's happening. But yeah, what you're describing there is called executive dysfunction, by the way. And yeah, when I learned that, when you learn a word for a thing you've experienced and you're like, it's a thing.
It's not crazy. It's huge. It's huge. Yeah. Realizing how big it is and how normal it is for people to have the same struggle.
How completely normal. Yeah. It's almost like by hearing there's a word, it makes it so real. It's like, well, someone has to have come up with a word because so many people experienced it that it wasn't just this one-off thing that didn't require one, you know? But yeah, executive dysfunction, man, I get that hard. I get that. It's this domino effect. And particularly like what you're saying on a normal day, just getting up, having a shower, I got to email that person, I have to go pick up that thing from the post office, but I can't do that thing until I've done this thing. At the moment, I've just moved into a new place and I'm trying to decorate, and I'm having that to an insane degree where I love decorating. I love nesting. I want to be doing this, but I haven't really been finding the process as enjoyable as I would like to. And then I'm getting annoyed that I'm not finding it enjoyable. But because, you know, I want to get that bookcase for over there, but I want to get that lamp for over there, but I won't know if that fits there until I put that there. And I'm ordering prints for the walls. But there's only a discount if you buy this many prints. And I don't know if I need that many for that wall yet. Until, like, you know, it's like stupid little things that are just, they're basically insignificant, but they kind of keep you awake. Not really me awake at night, anyway.
Definitely. You mentioned that you have you mentioned two things. You mentioned that you got a new therapist and yes, you're doing it on Zoom. In general, talk to me about therapy.
Oh, Jesus, how long do you have? that's a big one. I mean, I've been in therapy for about 15 years now, more, probably more. And I've had lots of different kinds of therapy and therapists. I've I always say to people, you know, it's like finding a good hairdresser, because I think a lot of people get put off the first time around when they don't find the perfect person. And you have to remember, this is a human being, and they're going to come with all of their good parts and their bad parts. And you might not gel, you know, in the same way that you just don't gel with people sometimes. And just because that one wasn't perfect for you does not mean you're not going to find somebody else. That said, it is, you know, it's a little like going to the hairdresser in that you're really trusting someone with something quite important to you. But obviously it's so vulnerable, and it's so difficult to do that first session again and again and again. Like that's always the hardest bit. But yeah, I've had sort of specific CBT therapy, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, for my panic attacks. And then I sort of got them under control, and later in life, I was going through sort of a new thing. Oh, dog. So, for people who can't see, there's a dog just ran by Sophie's feet.
just a random dog, my dog, but yes.
Yeah, I saw sort of several different therapists in Ireland, and it usually was around parts of my life where I was particularly struggling and felt like I needed to see someone. And my last therapist, her name is Rachel. She was just a godsend. I saw her for about 2 years, and for the first time, it was very clinical and very understandable and sort of structured in a way that I hadn't experienced before. So she's a trauma specialist, and she was the first one. Another person sort of said, oh, I think you have PTSD. I was in couples counseling at the time, and I was really struggling. I kept getting triggered in the sessions. I didn't know what triggered was. And she said to me, you have PTSD, and I think you need to go away and deal with this before we can come back to any kind of couple stuff. So I did. And for the first time, I had a word for it. I had a name for it. I could read books about PTSD. I could understand triggers. I could understand what happens in the brain when you're triggered. I saw, you know, actual images that of CT scans, and it just changed everything for me. And Rachel approached it with a very sort of three-step approach, which was regulation and then processing and integration. And I like that. I work that way. I write books and I make films and I do that kind of thing. So there's always pre-production, production and post, you know, and I'm so used to having that kind of a structure and things that it just gelled with me, and she was wonderful. And yeah, that was really, really intense, and genuinely one of the hardest periods of my life, because often, you know, healing is the hardest thing. But then I kind of had finished up with Rachel, and I recently in January and February was going through quite a bad bout of depression and decided to see someone again. And a friend recommended this new therapist to me. And yeah, so I've only had about 4 sessions with her now, and they've all been over Zoom. And it's the first time I've not met a therapist in person. So it's been very different, but she's a very different, again, a very different approach. I think I've done the sort of hardcore, heavy lifting clinical approach now. I've really put the hours in. And this feels a little bit more like talk therapy, psychoanalysis, Jungian psychology. Yeah, we're really just kind of talking through things and the bigger purpose, and the sort of like, you know, I'm feeling depressed because I'm not feeling purposeful. I think that's the big thing for me. So it's sort of, well, what is it that will bring me purpose and help me through that patch? So we're kind of just beginning to explore all that now.
So how do you handle, well, what are your triggers?
Oh God. Again, how long do you have? Triggers are a funny thing, I think. And it's important for anyone who doesn't understand this to I think take a little time to understand it, because so many people in the world are going through this. I think for so long the discourse around PTSD and around trauma in general was that soldiers get it, and that's all we knew. You know, in books and TV and film, we saw men coming home from war, and it was always, you know, the car backfiring, or, you know, the loud noise that sounded like a gunshot or a helicopter or something like that, or the sight of something that might like blood. Or we were always sort of trained to think that these are the only people who get PTSD and who have triggers. And so those triggers, they seemed so specific, like it has to look or sound exactly the way it was. And then I, so one of the books that I read when I was sort of figuring all this out was Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score. He's, yeah. I think he's Dutch, but he's like one of the world's leading experts on PTSD, and he's been studying it since, I think, the 70s. He began with war veterans, and having developed lots of different techniques for working with them, and I think, and you know, sort of very pioneering techniques for the time, even things as simple as like throwing a ball to one another while they were talking, just to kind of keep someone in their body, keep them in the room, and learning about the physiological changes and the detachment from your body and how to kind of get someone back in the body, exercise and yoga and all these kinds of things. Like, he was kind of one of the first people figuring all this out. And I just know someone's going to like write in and be like, actually, a woman figured it out 30 years earlier and no one listened to her. But anyway, Bessel did some really good work. And a little later in his career, he was asked to go work at, I guess, a clinic. I'm not sure I have all my facts on this, but he was working at a clinic where it was predominantly women who had been through some kind of domestic violence or sexual assault. And he found that the symptoms were all basically the same. And it was kind of, he was kind of one of the first people to say, hold on, this is trauma. This is exactly what I know trauma to be. But in some cases, it wasn't a singular incident. It wasn't an explosion that went off. It was years and years of emotional abuse. And then sort of complex trauma became a little more understood then, which is, you know, not a single isolated incident like a car crash, but years of living in that state of being hyper aware, of being scared, of kind of having to keep your guard up for a very long period, can kind of then lead to a complex trauma, which is even more difficult to untangle. So yeah, I've sort of gotten off my topic now. But I think what's really interesting for me is that we've sort of changed the narrative about what a trigger is. And I think what he also talks about and what lots of other psychologists are now talking about is that it doesn't always need to make sense. Like, your brain is such a complex, labyrinthian, like, mess. And it might just be that a certain smell triggers you, but you don't know why. It's not that it was the smell that you smelled in the room at the time, but at some point in your life, your brain made a connection between a sight and a sound, and that led to a smell, or, you know, and somehow this thing has become tangled in a way it shouldn't be. It's become intertwined in your brain with some kind of horrible incident or time in your life. So, which is all to say that my triggers are very unspecific. It's been kind of, it's something now at 36 I'm only really beginning to understand in a way that I can communicate properly to friends and partners. I think romantic relationships have been the most difficult for me. I grew up in a house with an abusive father. I was in an abusive relationship for 8 years earlier on in my life, with a man who was not very nice. And I think now that's the role that's most difficult to fill. and I have a lot of sympathy for any man who tries to fill it. You know, he gets me and I'm great. But also it's you know, it's not always easy. And it hasn't always been easy for me to sort of say, I can't sit down with someone and say, these are the three things you can't say or do because I'll be triggered. Because I don't understand it that way. That's not how it is. It's a feeling. It's, you know, you might say a completely innocuous thing that will lead to my brain telling me the story of something else. And the next thing, I'm completely triggered. So it's had to be more around understanding the types of situations where I'm more likely to be triggered. Definitely during sex is more difficult for me. So anything where I'm literally naked and exposed and being intimate or vulnerable with somebody, and that doesn't necessarily mean sex, you know, that could be kissing or cuddling or touching, I kind of need to give you permission before you touch me in any way. I find it difficult to blur the lines between like, we're just hanging out and now we're having sex. I sort of need a bit of a lead into that could be really jarring for me. So yeah, just being grabbed, even in a playful way, can really throw me. So that's the kind of stuff I've had to discuss with friends and loved ones about, you know, even if it's not a sexual relationship, honoring my boundaries and my space, my physical space, is very important. And I think beyond that, it's like, if you say you're going to do something, then do it. If you make me a promise, you have to see that through, or you have to at least acknowledge that you haven't, and that you're just nodding violently. Yeah. So, you know, for anybody who's had a trust broken in any way, big or small, that will lead you then to just feel like you can't trust people. And I think it will come out in the strangest ways of, like, you know, can you pick up milk from the shop and they come home without milk? Well, where is the milk? Well, you said you were going to get milk and you didn't. So, you know, you made a promise and you broke it, and therefore you are not trustworthy. And it's like, I can simultaneously feel all of that and know it, and know it's irrational. I can be over here being the observer going, that's not really fair. They had a long day and they forgot the milk, and that doesn't mean X does not mean Y. But these are the things that I think I prepare people in my life for, so that they know if it happens to just go, I'm sorry, you asked me to get that and I didn't. Sorry, I didn't do that. And then we're fine. That's it. That's all I need. And I think when you kind of understand that communication with people, when you have people who can be like that with you, that's really helpful. And then vice versa, because I get it, I can do that with my friends. And sometimes when they don't have the language yet, because I'm older than a lot of my friends as well, and they haven't been through the same amount of therapy as me, there's been loads of times where someone's reacted in that way towards me, and I've been able to not say, well, I fucking forgot because I was really busy. And, you know, I'm able to not lash out. I'm able to say, oh, that's not about the milk. That's pushed on something else. So I'll just apologize and I'll back away slowly. And I'll let them just do, you know.
Do you do that, or do you get, or are you the person who goes, do you think this might have to do with your dad?
I am when I think it's safe to do so.
Which is not mid-trigger.
Which is not mid-trigger. I think usually I will de-escalate, and then later on I'll say, so that thing, the thing with the milk. You want to talk about the thing with the milk? But there's some friends, I guess, you have a shorthand, you have a vernacular with, like, Dodie, who is my best friend, and we've lived together for, God, 4 or 5 years, I'm not even sure. And, you know, it's we definitely had a shorthand where, here's a great example. She's gonna kill me for saying this online. She was, I won't say specifically what, she was off doing a thing for the day that I knew was going to be difficult for her. She had to go do this thing. And I get a text, have I left my mascara in my room? And I went and looked, and it was there. And I replied, yes. And she replied, is it there? And I said, yes. And then she called. And she was just so animated. Like, you're just not being very clear with me. Is it there or is it not? Like, yes, I'll check, or yes, it's there. Like, I just, and she sort of went off on one, and I'm like, just immediately I stopped and I was like, I hear that this isn't about the mascara. I'm sorry that I wasn't clear enough about that, but you're going to need to take it down about two notches. And she instantly just dropped it and went, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to get angry at you. I'm having a day. I was like, I know you're having a day. It's fine. And that's it. That's as far as it ever needed to go. And that's the kind of thing that could become a big thing. And it just never needed to. We have this way with each other, and she'll do the same to me. You know, I'll go off on one and she'll be able to say, that's not about that, mid-trigger. But most people don't get away with that.
I'm going to try and circle into my question by going through your book, because your book, Out of Love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I always have the second guessing, like, what if I got the book title wrong?
Oh, bless you. I have that because I'm always afraid I'm going to pronounce the person's name wrong. No,
I know. Even I can see someone that I know for certain it's this person, but my brain goes, well, what if you got them confused with someone else? So I'll go, you're Michael? Like, yeah. Okay, good. Just checking. Your book, Out of Love, it's a love story. It's told in reverse. I'm now going to butcher it in terms of how to describe it, but the way you've talked about it is, I heard you in an interview say that external forces make us who we are. And your main character, Angel, but she's nameless, but Angel.
Yeah, we call her an Angel now.
We call her an Angel, but she's nameless. She has a lot of mental health issues, and she's basically described as she's not a perfect person. You know, but you also describe sort of the reasons that she is the way that she is. So I guess it sort of leads into what you're saying now about how your triggers can make you a person who does certain things or reacts in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm wondering sort of, I think it's a common experience to then feel super guilty that your own trauma sometimes affects people. I mean, I certainly feel that sometimes going, I am so sorry. I'm just triggered right now. So I'm going to be shouting a bit. I'm so sorry. It's not about you, you know, but somehow me shouting at you, I mean, that's unfair because I should have.
Yeah.
That's 5-year-old me shouting at my dad, right?
Yeah.
But I'm so sorry. I'm now shouting at you. So my question would be, so how do you let go of the guilt? Have you ever experienced the guilt or the shame around it? And yeah, how do you sort of forgive yourself for what they did to you?
Firstly, I'm very sorry to hear that that's something that you went through as well.
That's fine. Also 15 years in therapy.
Yeah, I just always want to acknowledge, you know, people bring stuff like that up and it's like, let's just take a second and be human about that. You know what I mean? Like that's really sad. And I'm sorry. God, geez, I wish I knew. I haven't let go of the guilt or shame around that. I think maybe I'm better at dealing with it now than I was maybe 10 years ago, but I can't count how many times when I need to reach out to people when I'm in a bad way. Sorry is one of the biggest words that comes up. You know, I'm like, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to rant at you. I'm sorry that, you know, I'm saying all this and this must be really heavy for you. And I'm sorry, sorry, sorry. And they're constantly saying, stop apologizing. You know, I'm here for you. It's okay. And I'm also very, very aware, and I don't always get this right, but I try more now to be aware of other people's boundaries. Like, okay, Hazel, you're having a meltdown. And it's 2 a.m. And I think there was a time when I'd have tweeted, which I won't do anymore. I very much try not to do anymore. If you catch me doing it, then naughty me. But I would have probably spammed internet in that sort of desperate hope that someone I know will see and reach out to me. And there's no judgment when I say that. That's just a thing I would do, and I understand why I did it, but I don't think I should have done that. And, you know, then just sort of spammed friends with very big, heavy text messages, or call them in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. Or even if it's not the middle of the night, even if it's just I'm having a meltdown, I'm spiraling, I'm triggered, I'm whatever, and I need to reach out to someone, I'm generally now more able to say, hey, I'm in a really bad way and I need help. Can you hear this right now before I launch into it? And I'm glad that I have friends who will be honest with me. It's very, very rare, but once or twice they have had to say, I'm on set right now, or no, like, no, I can't do that right now. But can you get in touch with this person or this person, or what can you do for yourself, or remember your training, do 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, do your breathing. Like, they'll send me a little kind of message being like, you know how you've got this, and they'll check in later. So yeah, I think honestly that goes a long way towards alleviating the guilt, because you've asked permission in the first place. So more often than not, would have felt a huge amount of guilt and shame around those late night things, or they're just bombarding people without checking. And then afterwards you kind of go, Jesus, I don't even know what kind of day they were having. Like, I didn't even check. I just launched in. So when you ask for that permission up front, you don't really need to feel as bad because they've said, yes, I'm here for this now. Yeah, I think that's one way to definitely help with it. And to have those conversations, like I said, you know, to sort of say, look, this is what I look like when I'm triggered. This is what is, I've sat people down and showed them these scans of the brain that I've seen, you know, because it helps them understand, like, hey, look, the entire left brain is shut down. It's black. And the right brain is all lit up and the amygdala is lit up. You know what the amygdala does? That's your fear center. So right when I'm triggered, it's like there's a fucking tiger in the room. I am terrified. My Broca center is shut down. That's my speech center, and my time center is shut down. So I think this is never going to stop. I have no perception of before or after. I'm just in, this is all there is. And when you show them that and you talk to them about, you know, your body being flooded with cortisol and stress hormones and your breathing into your chest instead of into your stomach and what that will do to you, all these different things, I think it really, not that we should have to make it physical to understand or accept it, but I think it does help a lot of people, including the person who's triggered, because I can kind of go, okay, if I can slow my breathing down, I can activate my parasympathetic nervous system, and that's going to stop the flood of stress hormones. So at the very least, I can stop more of them entering my system, and then I can deal with the ones that are already there, and I can make it kind of practical. Go ahead.
I also think the realizing how much it has to do with the body makes it. So for example, I see two different trauma therapists, and one is somatic experiencing. And she told me that if you push sort of on your chest, I'm trying to describe it to listeners, in the middle of your chest, and you push really hard, because yeah. that's usually where your tension will be.
Yeah.
So if you push really hard, it's like your body is telling, like you are telling your body, don't worry, I can hold the tension for a bit. And when you do that, it's like your whole body sort of just relaxes a bit.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And then you psychologically feel better, and you're like, hang on. Oh, so this is something I can control and change. It's like that bit back of your head where your spine ends. If you hold that, you will also feel a bit more calm, because that's where you were held as a baby. That's where the amygdala is. Like that will, when that bit of your brain feels a bit warm, it'll feel less terrified. And I, for me, realizing that, oh, but if I touch there on my body, I feel better. That reminds me that, oh, maybe there isn't a tiger in the room. You know, maybe I'm not about to die, because this is just inside of me, because it can be fixed by me pushing on my chest.
Yeah. No, God, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. Mine is a really tight squeeze.
Yes.
Can really help. If I have to do it to myself, I will. But if there's someone there that can just kind of hold me in place, that really, really does help. And I guess people's are different. And then, of course, you're up against, like, what if you don't want to be touched? You know, what if that's a trigger for you? But you need that sort of that kind of comfort. It's it can be really difficult to find that. And that's the thing. But it's such a process. It's such a learning experience. I still haven't figured it all out. I'd say I'm definitely handling it so much better than I used to. But that doesn't mean I don't have weeks at a time where I don't want to get out of bed, or I'm feeling very, like I said, you know, lately I think a big thing for me is this sort of purposelessness, so that's kind of coming up. But it really is about, as much as possible for me anyway, it's about educating yourself and understanding it. And if you don't want to, it's not about putting labels on it. I think that's another thing I'm kind of starting to understand, like those words really helped me in the beginning to be told this is PTSD. But you know, the DSM changes year on year. They'll call things like, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. Disorder is such a big word and so negative. There's so many connotations that come with that. And that was tough for me to take in. Borderline personality disorder. Like it makes you sound quite broken. And then other people call that emotional dysregulation. And I'm like, yeah, that's what it feels like. It feels like my emotions just aren't regulated properly. That dog is amazing, by the way. I'm having the best
He's now whining because he's sensing a cat in the garden.
Oh.
Very emotionally dysregulated right now.
Yeah, bless him. There's that. And then also lately I've been reading a lot about high sensitivity, highly sensitive people. And I've really resonated with that. It's like, if you are any of these 14 things, you're probably highly sensitive. I'm like, I'm all these things, bitch.
And that's so common for trauma survivors as well, because especially you said you grew up with an abusive father. I'm assuming that must have meant that you as a child had to be constantly aware and like vigilant,
yeah,
you know, as to, you know, how is he feeling today? How, I mean, now I'm just putting words into your mouth, but, you know, children from dysfunctional families,
yeah,
we usually have trained to be incredibly aware of what's happening so that we don't agitate and so we don't get in the way and so we don't make it worse.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you say like, sorry, I'm putting words in your mouth, but as someone who gets it, you never really are. When you what's fascinating to me is how similar these experiences are and how similar the outcomes are for so many people, which is why I think when I found like even just like Instagram accounts, there's one I follow for highly sensitive people. I can't remember the name of the doctor who runs it, but she's great and she does all these podcasts and stuff. And then there's other ones for survivors of trauma. And I don't want to fill my feed with this stuff, but I like having these things that pop up once in a while where the language is, it's like I wrote it. Like it, these are my words. And I send these things to my friends being like, oh my God, this is like, this really resonated. And they reply being like, you could have written this. And it really is fascinating how, regardless how dissimilar the experience was, how similar the outcomes are. And this is, I think it's something I talked about in the book as well. When she has that therapy session and talks about like not really wanting to go into the details of what happened to her, I feel the same, because often I don't think the details really matter. I think how it made you feel matters and how it continues to make you feel day to day matters. But sometimes, I don't know, there's a sort of morbid curiosity about the details. And I sort of feel like that's not yours. That's my story. And I'm not going to share that. But I will tell you is how it made me feel. And what I will tell you is how I've tried to heal from that. But I just sometimes think the details almost detract, or they sort of, not detract, but they distract from the real thing, you know. Like almost every friend of mine has been through some form of trauma, and I want to come back. I'm aware you asked a question and I want to come back to it, but the thing that I found so interesting is like what constitutes trauma. And I kind of said this at the beginning that like even when I said that, you know, I was then veering into people who've been, you know, very badly abused, and that isn't always the case. It, you know, a parent's divorce, one of your parents being ill, obviously one of them dying or being
moving, just moving ill, house or
moving house, moving schools a lot, being bullied, God, there's just so many things that can cause trauma. It's like, it's a bit like thrush. You know, when you read the leaflet, when you get the costume, it's like things that cause thrush. Wearing cotton underwear, not wearing cotton underwear, showering, not showering, breathing, existing. Like if you're a woman, you're going to get fucking thrush. Like if you're a human, you're probably going to get trauma. It's the same thing. It's just like, yeah, so much can cause it. And that's why I try and say to people, because people who are the closest to me who have heard my full story will sometimes feel like, oh, well, I don't get to call my thing trauma. And I'm like, no. You know, your parents divorced when you were 10 years old. And the fact that they divorced leads me to think things probably weren't great before that. You know, so you grew up in a chaotic environment and maybe you saw or heard them fighting. And that's tough. Like that's. You're allowed to say that that's trauma, you know, that's okay. Maybe it doesn't affect you as much day to day, but yeah.
Well, it's like if someone has broken their leg, you don't go, yeah, but this guy broke his leg in a really severe car crash, you know, so you're like, yeah, but my leg's still broken just because I fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make it less painful than the guy who was in a huge 7-vehicle car crash on the motorway. Still a broken leg, it still hurts. Yeah.
It's my leg and it hurts. It's my injury and my life's been changed and I need to adapt to this. But yeah, what you were saying there is absolutely true. And you were completely on the money. Yes, growing up with an abusive parent or sibling or anyone, someone who is unpredictable and chaotic and prone to huge sort of violent mood swings or that kind of thing, where one minute they're laughing and joking and they're completely trustworthy and the next they're just the worst version of themselves and they're a monster and they're making your life hell. And then 5 minutes later, they're laughing and joking again. That is just the pinnacle of, you know, sort of the seed of trauma. You're right. You spend literally your childhood. You spend so many years, and then if you're anything like me, you go off and get into another fucking relationship with some idiot, and you spend another 8 years.
Because it's what you know.
And that is not the saddest thing, that like it's comfortable and it's familiar, so your body kind of seeks it out like that. When I learned that, it was the saddest thing. And there's a thing in my book about that as well. So just for anyone listening, it is fiction. But I kind of pulled from certain experiences, particularly with therapy, in one chapter. And the therapist tells her about this experiment they once did with three lots of puppies. I'll make it quick. The first group of puppies were treated kindly all the time, taken care of, lots of love, lots of affection all the time. The second lot of puppies were treated like shit. They were starved, they were beaten. P.S. don't do this to puppies. And this was a long time ago when stuff like this was allowed. It's absolutely not okay. But the second group were treated very, very badly. The third were treated good and bad, and with no rhyme or reason. There was no schedule to this, it would just happen. And the therapist asked her, which group of puppies do you think were most loyal? And she says, well, probably the ones who are treated kindly all the time. You know, if someone's really good to you all the time, you're going to want to be loyal in return. The therapist says, no, it was the third group of puppies. Because when you're treated good and bad, and there's no pattern to it, and you don't know what it is that's causing it, you begin to assume it's something about you. It's something about your behavior. So if I just, you know, if I'm just quieter, if I'm just louder, if I'm just better, if I just, then next time I might get that nice treatment I got before, because I remember that was really nice. And then they come in and they're mean to you again. But next time, maybe. You know, and it's just devastating. And that's a real experiment, which is just horrible. But, you know, we're not that dissimilar to animals, to dogs in particular, in terms of that very sort of base level instinct, and definitely in terms of children growing up, before they're fully formed and before they have communication, and before they have themselves, you know, fully formed, they're not that dissimilar to an animal who's just trying to figure it all out, and they're working off of instincts. And so when you have a person who's that changeable and unpredictable and can cause you severe pain, but also you're programmed to think that they're right and to love them and to obey them, and this is a parent figure, and so you know they should be right. So yeah, that's such a mind fuck. And then it leaves you go into adult life constantly searching. That's it, you know, every room you go into, and this is when I talk about highly sensitive people, this is the sort of stuff I'm talking about. I'm so aware of the light in a room, the sounds. I constantly make people turn the brightness on the TV down because it's just too much. And they're like, you're ridiculous.
Yeah, I can't have a conversation when there's music. I'm like, no. One or the other can't do this. And they're like, why are you turning the music down? I'm like, you can't expect both things to be happening at the same time.
Sorry about the noise there. Yeah, completely. I totally get that. I can't write when I can put music on when I'm writing, but not music with lyrics.
No.
Very. And when I go to sleep at night, like things need to be so specific. I'm just so like, if there's a fan on or something, most people won't notice, and I'm like, I'm gonna kill the fan. You know, I'm going crazy. There's a fly buzzing somewhere in the next room. Yeah, but it's just because you're hypersensitive. You're in this state of hyper arousal all the time, sort of. Bracing, you're bracing for impact. You're ready for the next thing because you have to be for so long. That's the only way your body knows how to be. And then it's about sort of, yeah, just retraining, rewiring all of that. And that is hard work to rewire something so ingrained in you.
And I'm so aware that we have talked a lot about sort of the bad things that has made you in a way that has felt bad, but I also want to, like, so much of this podcast is about who, like, why you are the way you are, but that sometimes I just always forget to ask about the positives as well, like, because you're clearly, like, you're super successful, you've written an amazing book, you are clearly super intelligent and funny and personable enough that you have a huge following, that people are interested in hearing about your life, and So you've become like a pretty great person. What's the good bits that made you the good bits? Wait, what are the good things that has made you all the good things? Share. That's a sentence.
Do you mean the good things in my life that have sort of being the way I am? It's a funny one. I sometimes kind of think, you know, I'm all right in spite of it, not because of it. I sometimes hate that narrative of like it had to happen to you so that you could be stronger. You know, you could learn from it and be better. Like, piss off. I'd really rather have been all of those things without the fucking trauma. But also, I don't know who I would be without, you know, I can never answer that question. But yeah, there was a lot of good too. And this was something, you know, when I was sort of filling my therapist in, and that the new therapist in that first session, which I would say is, it's always difficult, that first session, like, let me just unload my entire life story to you, and some of it's pretty harrowing. One of the things I said was, you know, I was describing my childhood and my father and the abuse and that kind of stuff, and then in the middle of it I went, also I had a pretty good childhood. You know what I mean? Like, I know it doesn't sound it, but also I remember being a pretty happy kid, and I think a lot of that I owe to the rest of my family. You know yes, he was terrible, and yes, my mother really, really struggled through it, and there were periods where she was depressed, and sort of even sort of coping with that was difficult, but also she's like loving to an incredible degree, like, just I can feel love from her very, very clearly and very, very strong, and always have. And she was generous and caring and selfless and worked to the bone to give us a good home. You know, when he left, she had nothing. It was at a time when I think when they got together at the beginning of the 70s and she had her first kid, my eldest sister, she had to like hide her engagement ring from her employers because at the time a married woman couldn't work. So I mean that, yeah, it's a while ago now, but so she went through this entire marriage having never really had a job of her own, finances of her own. You know, you hear this story all the time of a woman there. Oh my god, there's an ice cream van. Wow. That's great.
It's the creepiest sound. It's a horror film sound.
It's
isn't
so
it?
Fucking terrifying, but also like summer, but also horrible. That's not even a good, so it's like green sleeves or something. It's really bad. Anyway, sorry. Trauma, yeah. No, so you hear a lot of stories of women who really aren't independent in and of themselves in a marriage, and that is why it's so hard to get out of these things. But when he was gone, she started her own business, and you know, she just did it. She just got it done, and she paid the bills, and she looked after us, and she cooked dinners and sewed up the holes in our clothes, and yeah, like she was that kind of mother. And I also have three older siblings, and as I said, so my sister is quite a bit older than me, so she was almost sort of a surrogate mother really, and I've got two brothers, and each one of them brought something to my life. You know, my sister and I were very, very close, and I guess I had a lot of that kind of just what a woman looks like from her. You know, she was similar, she graduated and she started her own business and that kind of thing, and I got a lot of that from her. She also just does not take any shit from anybody, but she's such a softie on the inside. I guess a lot like me. I guess we have a lot more in common than we ever really knew we did. And yeah, my brothers were everything about it. You know, we were a funny family. We were fun. We made fun of the silly things. That's a very Irish thing to do, but we joked about the most horrible things that had happened between those four walls because that's what we had to do to get by. And I also had my grandparents on my mother's side who were like the dream, like you just, you know, picture grandparents in a storybook, and that was them, and they were in love right up until the very end, and 50 years of marriage, and just so kind and so loving towards me, and very, very stable. Like my grandfather was the exact opposite of my dad. He was And actually, you know, it's really funny. You said at the beginning, you said the date is the 30th of March. It would have been his birthday today. And I was like, oh, because I don't ever really pay attention to dates. And it was only when you said it, I was like, oh my God, it was Kevin's birthday today. It made me kind of emotional. But yeah, he was a rock. He was very, very unwavering. You know, he was the kind of guy where the grandkids are all running around and you smash a plate in the kitchen and you sort of brace because you're used to being around the kind of man where that's going to be, that's your day gone. And instead it's, don't you worry, are you okay? You step back there, I'll clean that up. You know, just, and my grandmother was the same, just feeding you, just constantly just feeding you and slipping fibers into your hand. And yeah, they were just so steady. And I still, when I'm like meditating or I'm in that space where I'm just trying to be very calm, I often will go back to them. That's kind of the place. It's their living room or their kitchen. And I'm just there with them. And it's not like no one's even saying or doing anything. They're just pottering around and she's cooking up a breakfast or something. And it's, there's an energy in that room that's so safe. It's just so safe and so calm. And you don't need to worry about anything. And it's a lovely thing to go back to. So yeah, I had that and I had school and I had my friends and I had so many hobbies and interests and it was a different one every week. And I would start a class and I would end a class and I would try something else, but I was busy and I was always trying things and I was trying to be creative and singing and acting and writing little stories and drawing little pictures to go with them. And I consumed far too much TV and film, but no one took it away from me. So I just kept, I had a TV in my room. So I watched an awful lot of movies. I read an awful lot of books. I think stories were a bit of a Matilda thing, I guess. Stories were a bit of an escape. And I really got into that from such an early age. So I see now why stories have become such a part of my life and telling stories have, because I've always loved it in some form or another. But yeah, that's because there was so much good stuff. There was so much good stuff. And you tend to dwell on the bad stuff. But that wasn't the vast majority. It's just what kind of takes up space in your brain. But that wasn't the vast majority of my life.
I feel, I mean, I still have a million questions, but I've kept you for so long now.
Oh, no, it's fine. Jeez, I didn't even realize. I'm really enjoying talking to you as well.
Same.
Like rabbiting on.
I mean, I want to ask you if you've read the book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog.
I haven't.
You
no.
want to? I feel like okay. It's something you want to read, but that's another
okay.
thing.
Okay.
I want to talk about sort of your... this thing of like being yourself so much on YouTube and then writing a fictional book that's sort of based on some experiences you've had and lines. And I want to talk about, I mean, inner child work. I want to, you're bisexual. We could talk about that forever. Like, so much to talk about. But we've run out of time. So what I want to do is I am going to, as... I have to, otherwise she's going to keep backing.
Go,
give me 30 seconds.
So fine.
So what I'll do is I'm going to ask you a last question. Okay. Then I'm going to ask you about your book, like plug it. And then we're going to say bye. And then we're going to wait like 15 seconds. No, 3 seconds, a second. And then we're going to do like the extra bit for Patreon where I'll ask you some extra fun questions sort of. Just for the lucky patrons.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Okay. Well, the last question really is just sort of, we've been talking now for about an hour. How are you feeling? There's been ice cream trucks and we've talked a lot about like deep trauma stuff. And how are you feeling now? Where are you now compared to an hour ago?
I'm good. I think I'm probably more settled into it because you were a new face an hour ago and now I feel like we've connected a bit. It's a funny one for me. I think I do tend to sort of rattle stuff off and then I'll come away from this and in about 15 minutes it'll hit and I'll go, oh, you just brought up quite a lot of big stuff there. Do you want to take a minute? And I'll go, yeah, I'm going to sit down with some chocolate and a cup of tea. So that's probably what's going to happen is I'm going to sit down with some chocolate and a cup of tea and just, I like to give myself a little buffer either side of this stuff, like when I have a therapy day. This feels a little bit, honestly, like a therapy thing, you know, because you're pulling all this stuff
out.
Yeah. And I would be inclined to just jump straight back into work because I've got so much to do. But I think it's best for me to just let that sit for a second. Yeah.
I trust that you know exactly what to do to regulate.
Exactly. I mean, God, you know your shit. We need to have a separate chat to this, by the way.
Genuinely. I'm halfway through the Buddy Keeps a Score at the moment. It's on my nightstand.
Oh my God. Like, it's great, isn't it? It's so cool.
It's the Bible of CPTSD, right? It's the Bible.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for doing this. I mean, you have so many videos on YouTube that people can go and watch, and they're all great and different types of series and interviews and stuff. But your main thing right now is this book, which I've not thoroughly read all of it, but I've like skimmed it, and I'm so excited to read it, especially based on all of the like people like Aisling B, the way she talks about how she couldn't put it down, and yeah, talk about the book, sell it to us.
Oh, bless you. Thank you so much. Yeah, Aisling, that was a shocker. Aisling B, if you don't know, she has a series called This Way Up, which for anyone who watches this podcast or listens to this podcast, would, I think, really, really love that show, because it's a sitcom, but she does deal with mental illness in it really, really well. Through a very random set of circumstances, she got hold of my book before it was out, and she just sent me the most beautiful glowing review. She DM'd me on Instagram, and I nearly lost my shit. I was like, what? And replied basically in that vein. And she was just so lovely about it. And then so we put her quote on, we checked obviously, and we put her quote on the front of the book. And yeah, since then it's kind of I'm so astounded by the kind of people who've read it and who've said positive things, like Matt Haig. David Mickles, like, one day was one of my biggest inspirations for the book. So the fact that he read it, and then he ended up coming and doing an interview in my house, and we had this big chat. It was one of those dream moments. When you talk about best days, you know, it was one of those days. Marion Keyes as well, like, huge. Marion Keyes. That's been crazy. That's been a little bit hard to believe. But the book is, it's, my career was kind of all over the place. Like I said, you know, I always loved telling stories. I just loved stories. And I guess it's a very Irish thing. You know, we have the ancient art of the Shanachie, who's the storyteller. And you still kind of get that to this day. I think Irish people are just, they're just better at telling stories. Like, sorry. they just are, every other nation. And I didn't fully know, I still don't, you know, I haven't chosen a way to do that. It's just something that I love to do. I think for a long time I wanted to be an actress. I also loved writing, and I did a degree in journalism, and I studied writing at the Irish Writer Centre, which was mostly short stories and prose. And then I worked at Google for 7 years, and it all sort of fell by the wayside a little bit. And then the next thing, I started a YouTube channel. And again, it was just another outlet. It was just another way to tell stories. When people asked what my vlogs were, I was always like, I don't know, I'm just telling stories, like, about me, my life, anecdotes, stuff I've learned, you know, just like this. It's just talking, to a camera, like you're talking to a friend. And then it became sort of short films, comedy sketches. I veered a lot into horror and sci-fi because that's my jam. That's my crack. I just love that stuff. I love high concept stuff. And I couldn't really tell you how it got from there to here. I just kept telling stories in different forms, scripts and short films and spoken word sort of poems. And then this idea for the first chapter, which is called Muscle Memory, came into my head. I had been through several sort of big breakups, and that experience had been, I think, very big for me because of my emotional dysregulation, because that severing, that kind of connection, and that sort of feeling of abandonment and of loss was so much bigger for me. And I didn't understand then why. But this story, Muscle Memory, came into my head. It's about a woman who's, you know, just going through a breakup, and it's happening, and he's coming to collect his stuff. They are done. They are over, you know, and it's about her kind of going through the motions of coping with grief in those first few weeks and months, which we all know, anyone who's been through it, it's just one of the worst things you can go through. And I wrote that, and it really was just this standalone story. And then there was talk, my agent sort of talked about maybe making it a book. And I was like, oh, I don't know. It doesn't feel like one. I feel like I've just told the end of it. And I don't know where it came from. But at some point I thought, what if we go backwards? Because that's what fascinated me about them, this couple that I'd created, was where did they start? How did they get to here? Like, they're clearly so wrong for each other, but they've spent 5 years together. So they must have been right at some point. And it was that big question that you ask yourself, you know, when you're lying on the floor post breakup, that why was I with that person? Why were we even, were we ever happy? And then the big one, you know, was it worth it? Was it worth this pain? Was that, were those few years worth what I'm going through now? And is it a waste? Because now I'm 5 years older. And I have to, we see it as starting again. Oh, I've got to go find someone else. Like, that's the only point to life. So yeah, all those questions were what kept coming up for me. And that's why I decided to tell the story backwards. So the next chapter I wrote was the second chapter in the book. It's called Pissing on Sticks. And it's about her taking a pregnancy test, which is positive. And she's sort of trying to figure out what that means and whether she wants to be a mother and whether they're in a good enough space in their relationship to even do this together. The whole chapter is just sort of her musing on that and on motherhood and visiting her family and seeing her own mother and seeing her nieces. And yeah. And I kind of just did that as a challenge to see, can I go backwards in time? Can I take it from A to B? And what does that look like? And what does that leap look like? And then the next chapter I wrote was the very last chapter, which is the first chapter, which is where they meet and fall in love. So that then I had this sort of arc and I knew this is what they look like when they end and this is what they look like when they begin. And now I have to get from here to here. And the writing process was all over the place. Like, I didn't just go backwards or forwards. I picked random events from their time together. And once there was a skeleton of a story there, I wanted to fill in more and more. And then her best friend Maya became a bigger character than I had expected. And yeah, all these other characters sort of came out of the woodwork. And it was a really sort of organic process. And my therapy sort of informed it and it informed my therapy. And it was really, really interesting to kind of go through that. And now actually so it's been released in the UK. It was released last year. And it's been picked up by Penguin Random House in the US, which is amazing. Well, Dutton, who are a subsidiary of Penguin. So yeah, it's being published with Dutton in October. It's out October 26th in the US. And we've actually I've done kind of a new version because it was so rushed the first time. I didn't really get that time that Stephen King recommends where you put it in a drawer, you know, for a little while and come back to it. And having released it and taken a few months away and come back to it, I realized there were some things I would like to mostly add to it. I haven't changed it, you know, it's still the same story. I think a lot of people were scared that I would change the ending or something. But there's three new chapters in the new version. And yeah, just kind of a couple edits throughout and a little bit added to other chapters throughout. I felt like there was some stuff I wanted to expand on, particularly with Maya and with Angel and Theo in their early days. I felt like we hadn't really spent enough time with them being good. So I've added a chapter along those lines. And yeah, so new cover and new chapter and new launch, and I've got all that to look forward to. And it's crazy. It's very exciting. It's particularly in a pandemic. It's nice to have a thing that was already, because writing now has been so difficult. Yeah, I'm glad that there's a thing.
There is like the big question though, which is, will the sequel have to be a prequel?
I don't think there will be a sequel.
No?
Never say never, but I always tell the story I want to tell right now. I tell the story that's sort of bursting to get out of me, and that isn't. Like, for me, I've closed the book on them, so to speak. You know, Angel and Theo, they've had their time. I think if I ever do write a sequel, maybe a few years down the line, I think the thing I'd like to explore, I know you've only sort of read some chapters, but if you've read Summer Skin, you'll have met Lena. If not, you'll get there. Lena is a character I'd maybe like to revisit at some point down the line. I won't say much more than that. But okay. Yeah, I think there's more to explore there. I think she came out of nowhere and I wasn't expecting her to exist, and now she exists. And I'm like, oh, I kind of want to explore that a bit more. But no, right now I've just sort of finished working on the redraft for the US, and I've been working on a pilot script for the series, which has been optioned, which is really, really exciting. And I've been trying to write something new, which is, it's completely separate. I actually had a completely separate book all planned out, but it required traveling. And then this happened. And yeah, it was like a big plan for the end of last year. I was going to go do a bunch of traveling and kind of write while I went, and let that experience inform it a bit. But obviously that got knocked on the head. So then I had to kind of go back to, you know, the old notebook of ideas and what else has been swimming around. And there was one idea that kind of piqued my interest. And yeah, again, there's a couple involved and there's loss involved and there's love involved. And I, you know, this is clearly a theme I kind of will keep coming back to, I think, because it just interests me. But yeah, so I think that's the next thing.
And where can people find your stuff? They can buy the book in all good bookstores, and if they're in the US, from October.
Yeah, you can pre-order it now. If you're in the US, yes, you can pre-order, which is great.
And
if you can,
it means
help
a lot.
Me.
Yes.
Give me a little pre-order. That really, really helps authors out. But the UK version is out, and I think you can get it in lots of different countries. It just might be a little bit of a longer wait time. Absolutely. Most online places, and also, you know, try your local bookstore. I always try and encourage people, you know, when they're open, to pop down and say, hey, could you order this book in for me? Or even bookshop.org. They contribute their profits to various local bookstores around, you know, wherever you're living. So I try and encourage people to kind of support those businesses if possible. But if you can't get it anywhere else, and you got to go for one of the big guys, then fair enough.
And you're on all of the social media?
I am on all of the social media. Yes, I have my YouTube channel, which is just youtube.com/Hazel. Which I got because I used to work at YouTube. I gave myself that lovely little URL. So I still upload, like, not that regularly. I put something up a couple of weeks ago, but it sometimes can be kind of like months in between, because it's not my bread and butter anymore. You know, it's not my day job, but I love to just pop in and check in with the community. And I love that it's there. So it's so nice. So YouTube, and I'm also The Hazel Hayes on Instagram, Twitter. I'm mostly on Instagram, to be honest. I sometimes take breaks from Twitter also. But yeah, you can find me there, and you can find my book online, and I hope anyone who picks it up enjoys it. And please, if you do read it, message me, let me know what you thought. I love to hear from people.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There will be an extra bit uploaded to Patreon soon, where Hazel answers a few extra fun questions. So if you were considering becoming a Patreon supporter, this is the time. Go to patreon.com/Sofiehagen, SofieHagen, where you can, for just £5 a month, get lots of extra bits. You get special access to a Discord chat server where you can talk to other listeners and me, and you get many just little discount codes and videos and secrets and anything else I can possibly give you. Of course, you also help keep the podcast going. You help pay for the episode transcripts for people who are hard of hearing, for the editing, for website costs, equipment, and of course to keep it ad-free. That is patreon.com/Sofiehagen. SofieHagen. It's not with PH. I would also absolutely love it if you would sign up for my newsletter too. But I get it, you're probably already receiving too many emails telling you how to make your penis larger. You don't need my newsletter to tell you that too. Thank you for listening, thank you to Hazel for being a great guest, and thank you to Dave Pickering for editing the episode. Speak to you all soon. Bye!